Hey there, dog people of the internet. It's Sarah Stremming, the Cog Dog Coach, and this is Cog Dog Radio. Join me as I cover behavior concepts, discuss training ideas, interview experts, and explore my cases, all regarding the dogs we live and play with. Let's go. I have a phrase that I say all the time, and it is, only one of you is allowed to be a shit show. I say this, generally speaking, to indicate to handlers of dogs that if the dog is a shit show, the handler can't also be one. And don't worry, I'm going to operationalize this for you, but there's a third element here that matters. So I want you to think about three elements. One is going to be skill of the handler. So that's kind of the one that we were just joking about. The other is going to be skill of the dog, so training level of the dog. And then the third one that we want to worry about is going to be the challenge level in the environment. So if I'm in an extremely easy environment, I can have a totally untrained dog with a totally unskilled handler, and there aren't going to be any problems. But at least one party, either the dog or the handler, has got to have a skill set that is proportional to the challenge of the environment. So a highly skilled handler can absolutely get an untrained dog through a highly challenging environment. And likewise, a highly trained dog, or potentially a highly stable dog, you know, a dog that's just not bothered by stuff, will be fine in that challenging environment, even with a lack of handler skill in the person holding the leash. The big point here is that untrained dogs with inexperienced handlers need to be only in easy environments, because if you put an unskilled dog with an unskilled handler in a challenging environment, you're going to have a disaster on your hands. So for instance, I've got a friend of mine who is extremely skilled in her handling of dogs and in her observational skills in environments. And so she can bring her young dog, who has very, very few trained skills, into a lot of different scenarios, challenging scenarios, and everything looks fine. I was recently with her in an extremely challenging scenario for this young dog who has very, very few skills. And anybody watching wouldn't have been the wiser. They would have thought everything was going relatively fine, because of her ability to predict the environment and handle the dog in that environment. Conversely, we had a conversation about one of her other dogs who's highly, highly trained, who could have handled the tough environment that we were in much easier than the young, untrained dog, and would have required less of her skill in order to do so. Now, because her skill is through the roof and this other dog's training is also through the roof, almost zero environments are hard for them. This is why, you know, there's a phrase in horse training that's green rider plus green horse equals black and blue. And that's a, you know, a terrible analogy, but it's true. You don't put green riders on green horses. You put green riders on horses that know what they're doing. If you have a horse that is stable and skilled, you can put any rider on that horse's back and things will go fine. In order to have an untrained horse function fine and not kill anyone in a tough environment, the rider has got to be highly skilled. If you are a brand new trainer on staff with marine mammals or other exotics, they don't hand you an untrained dolphin on day one. They're handing you the dolphin who knows the routine, knows all the behaviors, and they're just teaching you how to communicate. Tough environments that I routinely see untrained dogs and untrained handlers. And when I say untrained, understand I mean the training is not up to par. It doesn't mean it's non-existent. It is simply not up to par. Examples of these situations are agility trials. Agility trials are very, very hard environments. The environment that is an agility trial will not be changed, will not be made less challenging. What is required is that at least one half of the dog handler team has the skills to handle that scenario. So if you're a brand new handler to agility, your dog needs to be either highly trained or relatively non-caring, highly stable to deal with that challenging environment while you learn better how to be a handler in that situation. Now, preferably for me, you learn how to be a highly skilled handler before you put your dog and yourself in those situations. You go to a good class, you have a good instructor, you learn a lot about agility so that you can bring your handling skills to the table there and make up for the fact that the dog is inexperienced. What I frequently say is that if the environment is challenging to the dog, the sport can't also be challenging. And the sport will be challenging if the dog does not have a competent handler, full stop. There are a lot of dogs, any given weekend, any given agility trial, whose stability and comfort with the environment is allowing for the handler to be the shit show on the team. Those dogs are lovely, but we usually don't breed them on purpose for agility. And a lot of people don't get into agility with those dogs. Another environment that I think this kind of proportionate sort of math problem shows up, it might be busy walking trails. So if I'm going to go walk my 11-month-old puppy Carson on a busy walking trail, I'm the one that's got to show up with a lot of skill because that's going to be a tough environment and she is only 11 months old. And I'm going to use every last bit of my skill in that scenario. If I were less skilled than I am, we would both drown in that type of situation. And I think that happens to regular dog owning public all the time. If you are a behavior professional, it's happening to your clients. That's why they called you. Spend some serious time working on their skills of predicting their environment and handling the dog, not just on the dog skills. Another one that people face every single day with their dogs are suburban and urban neighborhoods and sidewalks. These are really, really tough environments for dogs. And we generally don't give dogs the skills that they need because you got to be kind of a training nerd to give them that kind of skill set. So again, your skill set has to show up, and it is your skill set again of prediction. If you see a garage door that's open down the road here, you're going to cross the street. Or you're going to turn. You're not just going to walk right by an open garage because that's the kind of thing that loose dogs run out of. These are the scenarios where things go very badly. If you turn down a street and you've got a bunch of teenagers playing basketball in the middle of the street and your dog starts to go up on his toes, his mouth closes, his commissure pulls forward, his ears go forward, you have to have the skill to go, oh, this isn't going to be fine for us. I'm going to reroute, or I can't reroute, but I'm going to use my handling skills to get this dog past, or to make a quick judgment call there. Is my handling ability going to make up for the lack of skill my dog has because the environment just got much, much harder? And somebody's skill, again, has got to be proportionate to the environmental challenge. I'm constantly doing this math problem. If I'm out with Carson, you know, she's again 11 months old, we're out experiencing the world, and I see something that I know is going to be tough for her to handle, I go, okay, what do I have in my toolbox that's going to help us get through this, or do we need to avoid it? Can my skill set overcome this challenge for her because I know that her skill set can't, or do we need to get out of here? Unfortunately, dog training classes are like this all the time. You throw untrained dogs and untrained handlers in a room and everything's really hard for everyone. I would love it if dog training classes could be virtual for like the first 3 weeks and then you spend the next 3 weeks in person or something like that. What a great business model to help dogs and handlers learn the skills they need before they're thrown into the environment. And if you're going, that's great, Sarah, no one would ever sign up for that. First of all, I would push you and say, have you tried? But second of all, I recognize that teaching classes for the general public is always a balance between giving them what they think they want and giving them what you know they need. So I recognize that, and cheers, keep fighting the good fight out there. But how much information could you give them ahead of time? Could you have a virtual platform where you coached them, where everybody attended class on Zoom for the first 3 weeks? Something to think about. I do also find that when these proportions are off, when the handler skill and or the dog skill are just not going to be enough to overcome the challenges of the environment, This is where people rely on tools to manage the dog. And when I say tool, I might mean a front connection harness, but I also might mean prong collar. And do not go say that I told you to put a prong collar on your dog, because I did not just say that. All of those tools that exist are what I mean when I say this is where tools come in a lot of the time. Is where if my actual handling skill and training skill is not going to be enough to overcome the challenge of this environment because the dog's skills are simply too low or the dog's temperament is such, then that's where tools come in. Also, this is where overmanagement with food comes in a lot of the time. And for it to be overmanagement, then it needs to be problematic in some way. So if you are using food to get the dog through a situation, but you're not damaging anything with the food, the dog freely takes food and works for food in any scenario, and it works for you, then you're not causing any problems. In the same sense that I might switch Carson's leash from her back connection on her harness to her front connection to get her through a scenario, I'm not causing any harm or damage by doing so. I'm just leaning on a tool to make up for the lack of skills that are here. And then switching back to that back connection. I also might ask the dog to follow a food lure past a challenging environment and then feed them. That's leaning on my handling skills in that scenario. So when I say only one of you is allowed to be a shit show, I mean a lot of things. I do mean that you have to show up with the skills that make up for the dog's lack of skills. But I also mean that you have to control your emotions in order to make up for the dog not controlling theirs. So a kind of frantic, whiny, pacey, freaking out dog is going to be met with a very stable, very clear handler. If you're both pacey and whiny, we got a much bigger problem. And in that same sense, I've seen very chill dogs really taking one for the team with a handler that was just all over the place. And God bless. I mean, when I see those dogs, I just send them a little silent shout out for doing the good work. So if you find yourself in an environment that is too challenging for either your skill set or the dog's skill set or the combination of those, ask, could a tool make this easier for me? Could that front connection harness make it easier for me? Could pattern feeding make this easier for me? Ask that. If the answer is still no, that's not an environment for you to be in right now. That's an environment for you to get out of and work on, and then ask yourself, what are the skills that I needed that I didn't have, and go work on those. This is how we get better. We don't get better by saying, well, I was a shit show today. You know, guess I'm giving up. We get better by saying, okay, whose lack of skills the problem? Is it mine? Is it the dog's? I usually ask, which hole is easier to fill? You know, can I get better at leash handling? Can I get better at taking a deep breath? Or can this dog get better at responding to cues and taking food in different environments? And then what's my plan to help us both get there? Because ideally, nobody's a shit show and you guys are just out there living your best life. And a few Patreon questions for you. The first one comes from Vincy. And Vincy has a question about her year and a half old Border Collie cattle dog mix, who just as of a few months ago has started to bark at people trying to put clothes on. So particularly the people in the household trying to put on a sweater or put on slippers gets the dog charging at them and barking at them. And there was one incident in which the dog even jumped up and bit the person trying to put a sweater on. So what do we do about that is essentially the question. And what we do about that is we teach the dog to do something else. And while the dog is unable to do something else, we avoid provoking the dog with that situation. Okay, so if I'm going to put on a sweater, I'm going to occupy the dog before putting on the sweater. Because anytime this gets practiced, it gets stronger. It becomes a stronger response anytime it is practiced. So if you start to put on the sweater and you see the dog kind of get that exclamation point above his head, go, oh yeah, I don't put on a sweater in front of this dog. I put this dog in a crate. I put the dog outside. Then I put the sweater on. And meantime, I'm going to teach the dog to sit or down as I put on that item of clothing. And I'm going to do that at non-practice provoking levels. So that is the answer. It is simple, but not easy, and you might need a professional to help you. Next one's from Caitlin. Caitlin writes, just listened to your episode with Liza Rader regarding safe exercise. Thoughts on flirt pole play? Are there safe ways to do it? Any good resources out there on doing it safely? Caitlin, flirt pole playing is popular, so I'm sure that you can find some good resources. A quick search led me to a bunch of YouTube videos. Can't endorse any of them as I'm not familiar enough with any of them. Flirt poles are something that Liza certainly uses and uses in a smart way. I don't. They're not really in my repertoire, but that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them. Just like any other kind of play, you want to have some structure around it. You want to make sure the dog can still think around it. You want to have some kind of rules to the game. And then I'm sure that the flirt pole for a lot of dogs can provide a good outlet. Next one is from Jackie. Jackie writes, are there any special considerations for working through reactivity in a crate? And then Jackie goes on to describe that her border collie, while crated at agility class, can be reactive to other dogs approaching the crate. The dog is overall comfortable in the crate when things are quiet, but the dog kind of does two things. One is reacting towards dogs approaching or sniffing the crate, but the other is joining in with other dogs that are barking while in the crate. Jackie writes that covering the crate seems to help sometimes and make it worse other times. So the reason it helps sometimes and makes it worse other times is because of the function of whatever the barking is about. So my soapbox here is that dogs should not be put in a scenario where other dogs can approach and sniff their crate in any circumstance. And you might go, well, what about agility trials? Well, put up barriers, not a sheet over your dog, actual physical barriers so the dogs can't access your crate. And also crate in quiet spaces, especially if this is something that is bothersome to your dog, and consider crating out of the car, because it's not fair. It's not something that we work on because the dog doesn't have an escape avoidance option. They're going to choose the other option that they have. And it's not fair to expect them not to. As far as the dog just having a hard time with stimulation outside of the crate and joining in with that stimulation, I've got my Happy Crating bundle goes into this, because the second webinar in the series, so it's Happy Crating and Happy Euro Crating, goes into helping dogs to relax in those bigger, more stimulating environments. It is not a small project. It is a big project, as you might imagine, but it is also worth doing, and it is just an extension of the Happy Crating program. All right, Nikki has a question for us in regards to a Labrador puppy that urinates in the crate when it's time to let the puppy out. So he does not pee in the crate just because he couldn't hold it, and so he peed. He pees in the crate from excitement of being let out of the crate. The question reads as though he probably also did that while greeting people kind of normally, and that has gotten better. And the question is basically, do you have any advice to decrease that initial excitement and speed up his ability to hold his pee? So a couple of different things. One is that no, you cannot speed up the ability of the dog to hold the urine. That is simply a biological process that has to happen. I don't know how old this puppy is. Reading it sounds pretty young, and so it really could be that you just gotta keep giving this puppy time. But also, I would wonder how long is the puppy in a crate, and can we instead set the puppy up in what I call a puppy palace, which is a nice big X-Pen area that does have a potty area in it, so that the puppy's bladder is not full when you are also exciting the puppy, because that's your antecedent that's problematic, is that the bladder's actually full. If the bladder's not full, the pee's not gonna come out from the excitement. So I would be wanting to make sure this puppy has more opportunities to urinate than he's being given. And we really push crate training with dogs. We really push it, especially this is not Nikki's household. This is a family member. And so maybe not a dog nerd, maybe not a dog professional. And the Labby is just in a crate for maybe more hours than I would be comfortable with. I don't know if that's true or not, but can the puppy be set up in a puppy palace where it has somewhere to pee, so that the puppy's not practicing doing this either? Because it is possible that the puppy doesn't care about it and it might get built into the behavior chain of being let out of the crate, and that would be problematic. So it is mostly an age-related thing, but it's also about, we've got full bladder plus exciting situation. I would try to avoid the full bladder part of the exciting situation. Next one is from Sarah, who writes, I want to know more about how you teach and use tethering. Specifically, are you always tethering on a back clip harness for safety? If taught appropriately, is it safe to tether on a collar? Can tethering sabotage my harness collar cues? Or are the context cues different enough that this doesn't matter? So lots of people are asking about tethering ever since I kind of said that I use it. So I eventually will have some education opportunities on that. I just don't have it yet. But to answer your really specific questions here, am I always tethering on a back clip harness? Honestly, almost never. I'm pretty much always tethering on a collar. The reason that's fine, the reason that works, and honestly, you would have to make your own decision here, but I am fine with the environment teaching the dog when you put a dog on a collar, on a tether, they figure out that the tether is fixed and they do not hang themselves on it repeatedly, unless you're putting them in situations where they care more about the thing they're trying to get to than the fact that they are tethered to a fixed point. So I actually find that it helps them to understand collar pressure because we are almost never offering a fixed point from which the dog can learn not to pull. And that is one of the reasons dogs keep pulling, because we let them, because we bungee arm and we move when they pull and things like that. If if I'm going to teach a puppy truly not to pull into a collar, I'm going to start with a tether not attached to a person. So the opposite is true. It's not going to sabotage it. It's going to potentially help it if the other things you're doing are smart too. And I don't worry about it because I'm not just leaving them to choke themselves and I'm not leaving them unsupervised and things like that. So it's just not a concern to me. It might be a concern for others, and you have to make up your own mind. And then essentially my tethering program is the same as my happy crating program. All right, and last one this week comes from Megan. Megan writes, can you share how you teach a dog stillness for things like body conditioning, exercises, and cooperative care procedures? I've come across two ways to train it, and unfortunately, the trainer I'm working with uses a method that raises concerns for me that I think are along the lines of the concerns you and Ash discussed in All Things Food Drive. And Megan mentions that that method is incrementally, slowly bringing the treat to the dog with no cue. Essentially, this idea of our dog thinking we're offering a treat because we're bringing it towards their face when we aren't offering a treat. The trainer claims it's worked for 12 years and won't collaborate to find an alternative. The other method, putting stillness on cue by holding a treat in a closed hand in the air, seems to be less frustrating and confusing to my dog, but we aren't making much progress beyond a second of stillness. I'm hoping you have useful insights here. And then of note, Megan's Sheba has had some food issues. So Megan is really, as far as the triangular relationship between Megan, the Sheba Inu, and the food. And so Megan's trying really hard not to damage any food eating behaviors in the Sheba. And Megan, that's very smart for you to be thinking about. So number one, when something has really worked well for a trainer and you push them on it, and the only, what I'm trying to say is that it's okay for a trainer to not reinvent the wheel for you. If they have a program and you've signed up for their program and then you say you don't like their program, it's fair for them to say, that's fine, you don't like it, but this is the program, right? So that's kind of one thing about that trainer. I'm not sure who you're working with, but if you signed up for one of my programs and you said, I don't like this part of the program, and if that part of the program is a cornerstone of the program, I'm probably not reinventing the wheel for you either. So just kind of out of respect for that trainer, it's okay that they aren't thinking of something different for you if this is really pivotal for their entire program. There's probably a reason for that. And it might just be that the program's not right for you and your dog, and that is okay as well. And then it's a tough question to answer, Megan, because I don't really do this. Like, I don't teach them to be still by staring at food. I teach other stillness things. Like, I teach them a duration nose target, a duration chin rest, things like that. And build stillness into a lot of my other kind of operations, and therefore stillness is something they're going to choose to be reinforced. But I understand all of these methods that do teach the dog to be still staring at food. It's easier for dogs to be still staring at food than it is for them to be still without staring at food. But I would also question whether absolute stillness is required for the exercises that you're doing. So, without knowing exactly what you're trying to do, and without knowing the other kind of issues around, I would say if it's not a problem, it's not a problem. So if it looks like it's okay, you can keep going the way you're going. And if it doesn't look like it's okay, if it is showing problems to you, then that's when you need to pivot. So I have had Monique Fairchild on the podcast several times. I am scheduling with her to come on the podcast again. I like a lot of what she does for cooperative veterinary care. She's got a lot of different options for teaching dogs to be restrained and do different procedures that don't involve dogs staring at food. So you might check out her YouTube channel. But in general, it's kind of, for me, I think the difference here is that I'm not teaching the same thing that you're learning. And so I don't have another procedure for you because I don't even teach the thing that you're talking about. So to tie up a very confusing answer in a bow, you can teach stillness without the dog staring at food, but it does require your trainer skills to be higher caliber than the easier behavior, which is to stare at food. And it's kind of up to you if you want to go that far or not. Thanks everybody for your questions. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll rate, review, and subscribe wherever you heard this podcast. And don't forget to join Patreon at patreon.com/cogdogradio. And if you're interested in more content like the stuff you heard here, I hope you'll check out my online courses, my membership, and all of my offerings at my website, sarahstreming.com. See you there.